This is The Source on KSTX, a product of the Texas Public Radio Newsroom. I'm David Martin Davies. Lanier High School is known as the Pride of the West Side. Named for the American poet Sidney Lanier, the school was established not for the exploration of the arts, but as a vocational training for the city's poor. And in the pre-war years, the greater Mexican-American population of San Antonio went there. In 1939, the basketball team, the Vokes, won the city's championship, and that win sparked a riot. In several more years, that team won the state championship twice. The story of those victories and what it meant for the city's Mexican-American community at that time is told in the new book, When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio, 1928 to 1945. And we're joined by the author, Ignacio M. Garcia. Welcome to The Source, Professor Garcia.
Thank you very much, David.
And we definitely want to hear from our callers, our listeners. Please call in, talk about your stories, about playing for Lanier, playing for the Vokes, cheering for the Vokes. We want to hear from you. The number is 614-8980, 614-8980. So, Professor Garcia, first off, let's talk about the Vokes. What is a Voke?
A Voke is actually a gear. It was interesting because everybody that went to Lanier would ask, well, what is a Voke? And sometimes it took us years. I found out what it actually was when I was a senior in high school.
So, I mean, it's portrayed as a gear when you look at the representation of what the Vokes are, but isn't it like supposed to be, this is a vocational training, so they didn't really get a full-blown mascot. They just said, this is what you are.
Right. It was a vocational school. In fact, was the first vocational school, high school established in the country, or at least that's what the claim was by its early founders. So a lot of us thought that Voke actually, you know, sought to represent that we were a vocational school. So I think they just found the gear. And there's a real interesting comment in one of the yearbooks about how it was very working class oriented and how the working people of America were the real core of the nation. And so, using a gear and using the name Voke was something that that I think represented that. Although for most of us, we really didn't know what a Voke was, or at least some of us didn't, but we just knew it was our team.
And so you, in addition to writing this history about this championship team for Lanier, you are an alumni.
Yes, I am. I went there for almost 6 years. You know, it used to be that Sidney Lanier High School was both junior high and high school, so that all the kids from the West Side, those who didn't go to, there were a few other junior high schools in the West Side of San Antonio, but a lot of us went from the 6th grade, some 7th grade, and till the 12th grade. So a lot of us just sort of our growing up years was in one form or another connected to Sidney Lanier. And a lot of people found their spouses and their eternal friends there at Lanier. You know, we were just there so long.
So how did you come to write this book? And it's an exhaustive, it's like three books in one. To me, it's a sports story. And you're a former sports writer, is that right?
That's correct. For the Laredo News. I wrote for a short time there in Laredo.
Okay, and then it's also it's a sociological digging through, very kind of pointy-headed examination, because you're a professor and you have written many books about Mexican identity, and that's in there. And it's also an interesting history of San Antonio all woven into this one book.
Yes, it was a real labor of love, and I think all the things I've ever done, you know, I wrote on civil rights, politics, and, of course, I wrote sports. And then I went to Lanier, and I think everything just came together, and it seemed like I couldn't tell one story. I had to tell the story of the barrios of San Antonio, a little bit of the history of Mexican-Americans, and then, of course, the sports. And that's the one thing that I really wanted to make sure that, you know, sometimes as scholars, when we write about sports, we write about class, gender, race, everything that's very important, and forget to talk about sports, the actual game, the actual, you know, what happens on the court. And so having been a former sports writer and someone who loved sports but never had the capacity or ability to actually play organized sports, other than in the barrio teams or the church teams. It was sort of, you know, living a sort of a Walter Mitty life, being able to feel that I was part of the team there.
So just talk about the neighborhood, particularly at the time when you the pre-war years, because 1928 to 1945 is what you cover, and the area at the time, very different, but then not so different than we have today.
Yeah, well, an interesting thing was that, of course, it was in the west side of San Antonio. It's a huge area. There was a lot less housing back then around the school. The housing projects, which would be the Alasan courts, which were there, and which, in fact, my family lived there for a couple of years, had just been established, again, one of the first in the nation in terms of a massive, massive, at the time, housing project. And so a number of the players came out of that housing project. There were a lot of also community centers in the area. The Boys Club was very important. You know, you give kids something to do. There were English classes. So you had a number of churches who provided these kinds of activities, both for the adult residents, teach them English, teach them crafts, and also to keep the kids out of the schools. It was a lot of vacant space, as some players talk about it. And Lanier itself was really the huge sort of entity there in the barrio. There was also a lot of pecan shelling homes. By that I mean that people would take pecans from the factory, crack them, and then package them and take them back to the factory. So there was a lot of people in that area working in pecan. That was sort of, it was a very poor area. A lot of people didn't own their homes. There were areas that are sort of corral homes, homes that were sort of encircled or placed in a circle, and then you had your communal bathrooms. I remember living in one of these entities, because one of the interesting things that I found was that as much as San Antonio changed, there was a lot of things that were so similar. There was a number of, I think there were two theaters right next to the school. There was a bakery that still survives to this day, and I remember as a boy, and I lived about a block and a half from the high school.
Okay, so Professor Garcia, we're going to continue this. We're talking about when Mexicans could play ball. It's a history of San Antonio's Lanier Vokes basketball team when they won a state championship, what it meant for a Mexican identity in San Antonio. We're going to get into those aspects of the story after we take this break. We definitely, our phone lines are open. We want to hear from our callers, 614-8980, 614-8980. If you've got memories of playing for, cheering for Lanier, if this victory, if this their heritage of winning means something to you, we want to hear from you. This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking with Professor Ignacio M. Garcia. He's written the book When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio in 1928 to 1945. He focuses a lot on the era when William Carson Nemo Herrera was the head coach, and during his tenure, he won two state championships, five regional titles, two third places, and one second place in the state bracket. That's quite a record for Lanier High School, the Vokes, when they said that this was a team that couldn't play, they couldn't compete, that they had no business being on the court. Is that right, Professor?
Well, yes, they were quite a small team. The school itself was small compared to some of the larger schools in the city. And, you know, that there was this feeling that they couldn't compete. They were too slow, too short, didn't have the skills necessary. But, of course, nobody ever told Nemo Herrera that. He was a very talented coach. In fact, he had played for Brackenridge High School and been a star basketball player, then went to Southwest, University and was a star athlete there, and then went out and coached baseball. He was a very good baseball player, ended up coaching baseball in Mexico, and meets his wife there, who was a nurse from Louisiana, a young lady from Louisiana who was in Mexico at the same time. And when so he decided to come back home, and that's where he was able to get a job at Lanier. So he was a very talented coach, and so he was able to teach these young men how to play ball.
And he demanded excellence from them, and he ran them ragged, you know, got them into condition so that they would be able to play and compete. And he used innovations of the game to their advantage. It was at the time, it used to be that it was very slow. Basketball was very slow. You know, you watch the movie with Gene Hackman, Hoosiers. They just want you to pass the ball until you get it to the big man, and he gets the high percentage shot. Now we had these this team, scrappy kids from the West Side. They didn't have the height. Not one of them was over 6 foot, not even close to that. And they wanted to come in and just sharp shooting and speed. Is that how they managed to win?
He actually uses himself as a model, because he was about 5'3", 5'4", some people say even shorter than that. And so he learned to play fast. He learned to dribble fast, to be able to get in position, because people didn't do jump shooting back then. You had to find a spot and then, you know, shoot the ball. And so he taught the young men how to do that, how to play a lot faster than they were. And although I must say he did have, luckily, one, you know, every year that he won, he did have one tall young man, about 6'2 or 6'3. But then again, he was, you know, as a center competing against young men that were 6'7", 6'8". So he did have, you know, in terms of the West Side, he did have at least one person that was tall. But relatively small compared to most of the centers from the high schools during that time. So, yeah, he just ran them ragged, and that was the one thing that the idea was, at the end of the ball game, you could still hit the free throws because you were in enough control of your body that you could run and tire out people. And sometimes it took him, you know, all the way to almost the end of the game before they caught up. And then eventually they became so good that they were blowing teams out of the game. They became very, very good teams.
Our phone number is 614-8980, 614-8980. We're talking about the book When Mexicans Could Play Ball. The author is Ignacio M. Garcia, and he's a professor of Western and Latino history at Brigham Young University. The books he's written, White But Not Equal, United We Win, and Viva Kennedy, Mexican Americans in Search of Camelot. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the conditions and around Lanier on the West Side in these pre-war years. This was the streets were paved, but there were no sidewalks. There was no drainage. Tuberculosis was rampant at the time because of the pecan shellers. When they had they won the game in 1939. That was just 1 year after the famous pecan sheller strike of San Antonio. So, and it's interesting that tuberculosis is also what ended up killing Sidney Lanier himself. But this was a part of the town that was neglected. This was the wrong side of the tracks.
It was. You know, it was. But a lot of people forgot to tell the Mexican-Americans who lived there. Now, most of them were poor. Most of them understood their condition. They realized that there was actually an actual barrier between them and the rest of the city. But it was also a community that was alive. This was a lot of internal community building. There were activities. There were churches. There were mutual aid societies. There were, you know, community centers. It was, in many ways, the interesting thing about the West Side of San Antonio is that it was poor. People struggled tremendously, but it was also very vibrant. And given that Mexican Americans were segregated during that time, a lot of the successful, whether they were, you know, lawyers or doctors, the few of those, where they were small business people, all of them lived in the west side of San Antonio. So in some ways that had a sense of community. It had his doctor, it had maybe its one lawyer, it had his businesses, it had his mechanic, it had his theater. And so while poor, it was a vibrant. And one of the things that these players remember is that theirs was a vibrant community, and there was a sense of pride in being from the west side of San Antonio.
Yeah, but you bring up the fact that it was a segregated city, and I think that is something that we forget in San Antonio, that this very much was a segregated city. One quote you have of one of the players in the book is that I could play in these state tournaments, but I couldn't swim at Woodlawn Lake.
That's right. And the players would talk about when they would go downtown after a wonderful game, and everybody was excited, and maybe the sports writers had said something nice about them, but they still confronted the reality they felt as foreigners in some parts of San Antonio. Now, some kids, some of them navigated it better than the other one. If you were a little bit better dressed and not as dark skin, and your English was a lot better, then you could do better outside of the west side of San Antonio, because Mexican-American segregation was different from African-American segregation. There were shades of fluidity there that may not have been for African-Americans. And so it was a lot of navigating that these young men had to do, and or all west side of San Antonio residents. You navigated, you knew where to go, you knew how to act, and you quickly came back and then were free to sort of be yourself.
Yeah, but this was a transformational period for Mexican-American identity in these pre-war years, particularly in South Texas. And
by then you already had a Mexican-American civil rights movement. It was small. The League of United Latin American Citizens, or LULAC, was already strong. And San Antonio was always a hotbed of Mexican-American activism.
Right, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the role that this team played in inspiring people and being a proving ground for what happens when you give Mexican American kids the opportunity and the tools and the training that they need, that they can compete with anyone across the state of Texas. And I think that's what this team showed. So we're going to continue this conversation. We're going to take a break, and we will come back in about 10 minutes. But just hang in there with me, Professor Garcia. We're going to talk more about your book, When Mexicans Could Play Ball, here on The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We'll be back. Welcome back to The Source on KSTX. I'm David Martin Davies. We're continuing our conversation with Professor Ignacio M. Garcia, his book, When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio, 1928 to 1945. In 1939, a team of short, scrappy kids from San Antonio's impoverished West Side won the city's basketball championship. It was an overtime, sudden basketball wins the game in overtime, and that gave Lanier Volz the big win. That also caused a riot in the basketball gym that spilled out into the streets. So, Professor Garcia, tell me about this riot. Why was there a riot? Because the Volz Lanier won the game.
Well, I think the both teams had split their two games in the season. They were both close.
So that was the Brackenridge Eagles. Right. They were the rivals.
Right, and the Brackenridge Eagles had gone and done something that was very rare, and that is beat Lanier at their home. So I think there was intensity there. I think both considered to have good teams that could go on and play at the state. But I think, in a way, this was a big arena. And here you had people in two different groups in San Antonio who had lived side by side, but with a lot of tension. It was just about the beginning of World War II. I think there was a lot of elements that went into it. But I think the way they won, I think the way coming back and sort of snatching a victory from the jaws of defeat and doing it in the way they did it, it's sort of the straw that broke the camel's back in terms of relationships. And I think as Mexican Americans were celebrating, it really spoke to the dawning of a new era. And I think someone who went. And it may have been that person had no racial or or ethnic problems with Mexicans winning. Might have been just a fan of the school or a relative. But once he struck a blow, it just, you know, just let loose all the emotions between the two groups, and they went at it. And in some ways, it's a reflection of Mexican-Americans being able to sort of go out and do this outside of their home. Not that they were picking a fight, but simply it was a sort of an explosion of feelings. You know, we forget that San Antonio was a very divided and in sometimes a very hostile place for Mexican-Americans, and there was that kind of conflict that was available. At the time, you also saw the rise of gangs, a lot of Mexican-American gangs at the time. And so I think that, you know, both communities were sort of confronting new realities, the war years, that it was just a very tense situation, and it allowed for feelings and emotions that had been bottled up for years to sort of come out into the open.
Our phone number, if you want to join the conversation, we're talking about the Lanier Volts when they played for, when they won the state championship. And this is in the pre-war years of San Antonio, what it meant for Mexican-American identity. Our phone number is 614-8980, 614-8980. And our guest is Professor Ignacio M. Garcia. The riot, let's talk about this riot a little bit more because it's fascinating. The game is being played at Breckenridge. The Lanier, they score the winning basket. People flood the court and celebrating. And then someone throws a punch at the kid. Was it Tony Cordova? Was that his name? Who won the shot the winning basket? And then it was, you know, hell's bells. All breaks loose. Someone gets Tony out of there, and they hide him in the back of a car. And people are just throwing punches. The police come. You say that because the riot happened at Breckenridge, that the police were much more restrained. That had it happened at Lanier, it would have been a lot more heavy-handed response.
Yes, I think so. I think you see, if you compare to what happens in Los Angeles a couple of years later, in which Mexican-Americans are accused of rioting, even though it was sailors who rioted in the famous Suit Suit Riot. The police went after the Mexican-Americans, arrested them, threw them in jail. But here was a situation in which the fight had not been started by a Mexican-American. It has been started by a fan from Breckenridge. They were at Breckenridge. And I think there was, you can tell in the newspaper coverage, a real attempt to play down the issue, that it had been a game, it had been a tight game. They didn't deal with the whole notion of how much ethnic and race came into play. And one of the interesting things about San Antonio at this period of time is that there's a sense that we're going to keep these kinds of conflicts below the surface. We're never going to talk about race. We're not going to talk about, even in terms of dealing with Mexican-Americans, there were code words instead of any kind of blatant discrimination. And for Mexican-Americans, confronting a situation in which they were trying to become assimilated, they were trying to sort of be part of the larger society, and even for some of them, because some of the players to this day, they don't want to play that in the context of what it was, which
right.
was an ethnic racial fight.
They don't see it as a victory for Mexican-Americans. They see it as a victory for their team. But it was
right.
people in the outside in the neighborhood who were looking for things to hang their pride onto, found something that was exceptional within them that they could point to.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because the Lanier, you know, administration really wanted to create these young patriotic students, and they also had to navigate this ideal of this racial divide, and so they, you know, so they didn't talk about those things, and so it's interesting how that generation of Mexican Americans found it very difficult when they were, you know, in what we call a public language to talk about these issues. Now, if you went with your neighbor, if you were, you know, there at church or in the bar, you would talk about, you know, such things as discrimination and prejudices and unfairness. But in terms of the public discourse, and many Mexican-American generation activists, reformers, also attempted to engage in a public discussion, without without using the terms biases, discrimination, racism. So it was a very interesting period among Mexican Americans who saw themselves as finally getting there, but having to use a different language to describe, even as they, they really fought for.
One interesting thing, as you write about in the book, is about how Edison High School at the time was a predominantly Anglo school, and how they were so upset about the sports victories of Lanier that they kept accusing them of cheating, and the extreme accusations and what they would go through is amazing. And then that Edison declared they would never play Lanier again in football because they kept accusing them of somehow cheating, of being too wily and crafty.
Yeah, they couldn't believe that these kids could play the American games of football and basketball and just assume that there must be a problem. And, of course, what complicated the issue was that Lanier was both a junior high and a high school. And so in the first accusations, what was really interesting was they were saying that Lanier had an unfair advantage because they were using eighth graders.
Yeah, that's,
which
that did
over as well with the public because they could sort of buy you're using older kids,
sure,
not younger kids.
We're going to take a quick break. Professor Garcia, we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break. I want to talk about the legacy today at Lanier, what's happening there. Call in if you're listeners. If you want to join the conversation, the number is 614-8980, 614-8980. This is The Source on KSTX. This is The Source on KSTX. On the phone, talking with Professor Ignacio M. Garcia. He's a professor of Western and Latino culture at Brigham Young University. He's written books, White But Not Equal, United We Win, and Viva Kennedy, Mexican Americans in Search of Camelot. His latest book, When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio, 1928 to 1945. Why dredge all this up, Professor Garcia? You know, if we've kind of forgotten that San Antonio was a harshly segregated city, why not just ignore that?
Well, I think in part it was so much of my experience. And I think that San Antonio is a very important city in terms of Mexican-American civil rights efforts. There's a number of people who come out of San Antonio, who come out of the West Side, who will be important in Mexican-American history. And I think it's also good to sort of unmask some things. I think when I was growing up in San Antonio, one of the things I noticed was how we would sometimes never talk about these things and never dealt with them. But in reality, my interest was to talk about a group of young men and the school that supported them and the community that was very proud of them and what they did. And it was very difficult to tell the story of these young men without talking about the problems they confronted, both in terms of their poverty, in terms of where they came from, in terms of their height, but also the hostility that sometimes they faced. And yet how positive these young men were, or they're not young anymore. They're all, those who are still alive are in their 80s and 90s. And I find them without bitterness. I find them, very proud of what they did, with wonderful memories both of their school, San Antonio. I mean, this is the kind of citizens that you want to develop in any community. But they were they developed in through a refiner's fire. And what is so amazing about them is a sense of maturity in the way they talk, even in dealing with these harsh issues, but there's no bitterness there. And I think that's something that we can learn from if we are going to completely resolve issues, is to look at people who are very open about what happened and what they confronted, and yet so positive about their experiences.
One of the players on the 1943 championship team, Tony Rivera, was recently honored at Lanier High School. That was just earlier this month. He played on the championship team. He received a scholarship from Oklahoma, but then he was drafted to go fight in World War II, where he was wounded twice and was awarded Purple Hearts twice. And so he was a war hero, a great American, a product of Lanier Avoc.
Yes, just about all the young men that played in the teams served their country. By the end of in 45, before the end of the school year, all of them were in the Army serving their country.
Earlier, we talked about the poverty that existed in that neighborhood during the era that you're right about in the pre-war years. But looking at current data for that area, it's zip code 78207. 51% of the families who have a child there under 18 live under the poverty line. 35% of those in that neighborhood who are the working age they have a 35% population of unemployed of those there. The lowest mean household of income of the state there at $26,485 a year. 60% of the adults, 25 and older, lack a high school degree. So this is still a neighborhood that is challenged.
Very much so. Communities like those seem to resist massive upward mobility. And then, you know, when you see this sort of integration come in, of course, you see a lot of talent, a lot of potential leave as they seek other opportunities. And so in many ways, you leave a community that has sort of less education. There's also more recent immigrants. And in many ways, the west side of San Antonio is sort of a proving ground, an evolving ground in which people come, they try to evolve
yeah.
past it, and sometimes they can't, but their children are.
Okay, let me get a caller on the line. Our number is 614-8980, and we have Charlie Herrera. And Charlie, welcome to The Source. I understand that Coach Nemo was your dad.
That is correct.
So welcome to The Source. What can you tell us about, Lanier and your dad's years as a championship coach?
Well, I can tell you that Dr. Garcia's book was extremely, it is outstanding. It's a marvel at the amount of research he did. I spent a lot of time not only reading the book, but also reading the notes that he had and all of his references. But Dr. Garcia, if you would make a few comments, if you could, about the contributions you think my dad had in building the character and the focus of these young men and what it meant to them and how they were successful as a result of some of the things that he did for them.
Sure, I'd love to. You know, knowing Charlie has given me a sort of a glimpse at what Nemo might have been like since I never met Coach Herrera. But every single one of the players, when they spoke about Coach Herrera, you could see their eyes just sort of light up. You could see the countenance. And I remember even when somebody might, you know, take issue with something that happened in training, they would always end the comment, but Coach Herrera knew. He built character. He was there to build character. He understood that these young men were going to confront difficult situations. And he didn't lament that, neither did he provide a crying shoulder. He would just say, go out, play, win. Because if you win, that's as big a blow against whatever animosity people have, whatever they treat you. You win, and you come out of there, you know, a person satisfied and proud. I think that Herrera represented for many of these young men a sense of their bridge to American society. Because here was someone who was well-educated, someone who had succeeded in the other side, and he was there, and he was telling them they could do that. He got kids, some of them, to move away from vocational training into more a traditional academic program to go to college. He was constantly looking for colleges to take his boys. And he would, he would drive them sometimes to the Army Depot or the recruiting office and sort of bid them goodbye. And when one of his players was badly injured, he went and spent an enormous amount of time at his side. You know, people like Nemo were so valuable, even though there were so few, to these young people and in the West Side. They sort of represented a beacon of hope that you could, you know, live in the West Side, grow up in the West Side, and still be able to accomplish. And I remember...
Professor Garcia, thank you so much. We're out of time. I would definitely want to thank you, Ignacio M. Garcia, professor of Western and Latino culture at Brigham Young University. His latest book, When Mexicans Could Play Ball, Basketball, Race, and Identity in San Antonio, 1928 to 1945, telling the incredible story of the Lanier Vokes as they won the city and state championships in the pre-war years of San Antonio. Thank you for joining us this afternoon, Professor.
Thank you very much.
And this is The Source on KSTX. Thank you so much for tuning us in. I'm David Martin Davies.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. David Martin Davies is executive producer and host. Paul Flav is the show's producer. Management and oversight comes from VP of Programming Wayne Coble. Chris Udaly is the TPR web editor. Support for The Source comes from the contributors to the Community Engagement Fund, including the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.